Hello and welcome. You're tuned into the best in true crime talk radio. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. With me, my own Mr. Watson, Tim Dennis. Hello, Tim.
Hey there.
All right, sir. Dumb crimes, stupid criminals in just a bit. I want to remind people, thank you so much for sending stories into us every week. I mean, we have two or three listeners who send in at least two stories every week, and it's great. Thank you very much. We appreciate that. And they're digging so that it's not always Florida man that we're picking on, Tim.
Yes. Yeah.
But we've got some crazy stuff, including some airport news that's really bizarre. And one of them takes place right here in our own backyard. And it's very unnerving, very uncomfortable. Yeah. So we've got some of that to talk about. And the second airplane story, I totally agree with. I think you will as well once you hear the crime that was perpetrated upon humanity. Okay. So make sure you stay tuned in. We'll be doing that. We've got some other stories coming in. But if you have a dumb crime or a stupid criminal story from your area and you'd like to hear it featured on the show, just email me, dave@darknessradio.com, and include a link to that story. You know why I say include a link, Tim?
Because if you just say, here's a great story, Dave, and don't include the link, we have no way of finding it.
Right. Yes, that's right. Exactly it. And right. Do you know that at least twice a week I get an email from somebody who sent me a story? Oh, you guys should talk about that story about the guy that held up the Shopko with a 5-pound salami. And then they don't send me a link. So then I got to go fish around for, I mean, it's not that hard. 5-pound salami robbery usually pops up pretty quickly, Tim.
Yes, it does.
Usually. But there are some instances where I find 4 different 5-pound salami holdups in different states. So,
and it could be from 5 years ago, too.
Yeah, so, exactly. Yeah. So so we got that going. dave@darknessradio.com. Email me your dumb crimes, stupid criminals, and a link to that story. I'd also like to get back into, are you a dumb criminal? I mean, we've all done something stupid as a kid, right? Mm-hmm. We've all done something. And I want to know what your dumb story is. Did you get arrested? Did you, break into the old haunted amusement park and find out that it was old Mr. Smithers haunting the place? We want to know your story. So you can email those to me. We'll read them and share them on upcoming episodes. Let's get to it today. She is Evil. Not our guest, Tim. Judith Yates is delightful. But the book, She is Evil, Madness and Murder in Memphis. Judith has been with us on numerous occasions, and I'm so happy to have her back with us this week. Thank you so much for being back with us, Judith.
Thank you. And you know what? I'm sitting here trying to think of a dumb criminal story because I know I have one in the 30-plus years I've worked.
Right.
So well, I'm going to have to chew on.
Yeah, if it comes up near the end of our segment with you and you could think of it, otherwise just, you know, you can reach out anytime. We're always happy to hear funny and weird stories of unusual criminals, which leads us to your book. Now, this book's a little bit older in your release, and we do have a link for the book up on today's program guide to make it easy for everybody to find it. But talk us through this. This took place in what year? 2003?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm sorry, my microphone failed, so I had to...
So
when you spend $10 on equipment, you get $10 for equipment. But yes, it was 2003 in May.
All right. And talk to us about the situation. Set up the scenario for us, if you would.
Okay. Let's see. Ijaz Ahmad was born in Pakistan. And his family worked very, very hard. They had their own business. They were exiled with nothing. And they went to Pakistan and they started their own business literally from nothing and built it up. It was a store, and his mother sewed and his father ran the store. And the children, as soon as they were old enough, they learned the importance of prosperity and the importance of working for what you want. So Ijaz and his siblings worked the store. Now, Ijaz was very intelligent. He was working on his degree, and his mother came to him one night and woke him up, and she said, I want you to go to America and make your fortune, because America, of course, being, you know, the place to make your fortune.
Right, land of opportunity, sure.
Oh, yeah, and so they walked out on the balcony overlooking the street and the store and sat down. And she took his hand and was squeezing it very tightly and said, I want you to go to the United States. I want you to make your fortune. It's important. And Ijaz is like, why are you waking me up in the middle of the night? And she said, just promise me. Then she had a heart attack and fell into his arms, instantly dead.
Wow.
So Ijaz made a promise to her, and he came to America. Now, understand, Ijaz didn't speak a word of English, but he went to a school, and he learned to speak English as a second language, and he began to work. Now, Ijaz was this kind of a Renaissance man. Everything he touched, he made into an income. He wasn't rich, but he was well off. He, for example, took bicycles that he found in the dumpster or what have you, and he refurbished them and he sold those. So anywhere Ijaz saw a way to make something of nothing, he would do it. Now, he also went to school in America. He had 2 degrees in engineering, various engineering sectors, I guess you'd say. Mm-hmm. So he was constantly working. And this was Memphis, Tennessee, by the way.
And what was life like for him there? I mean, obviously, you know, this guy's industrious. He's hustling. He knows how to make something out of nothing. But what was his personal life like?
Well, the only thing missing in his life is he wanted a wife. He wanted someone to be by his side and to honor. And I need to interject here. Ijaz was a true Muslim. And okay. I know immediately everyone thinks Muslim terrorist or Muslim, someone who beats their wife. This is not true. Not true. And he was a practicing Muslim. You honor your wife. You honor one another. You help one another. This is very important to the story. You help people in need. You help your community. And of course, he went to mosque on a regular basis. So Ijaz becomes friends with this older lady who happens to have a daughter. And he meets her and they just instantly click. She told me, she said, I came into the apartment. I looked him in the eyes and I could not stop. It was something about him.
That's sweet.
Well, they marry and they have a son and they're just madly in love. Now, his ex-wife, she had gone through some rough stuff as a child and as an adult. And she found a man that for once she was his equal. He walked beside her everywhere they went. He worked hard to make sure the family prospers. They have a child together. And just a bright kid, a very bright kid, because I saw videos of Ijaz and his son, and Ijaz talked to his child like an adult, and he would ask him questions like, what are your dreams? And what do you see in the future? And how do you feel? And those are, you know, it wasn't goo goo gaga. He was speaking with his child in a very loving way. He was crazy about that young man. Well, he and his wife are doing well, and his wife was a devout Christian and followed the Bible, followed those beliefs. But she would wear the hijab when it was important to Ijaz out of respect, she said, for his community and himself. Well, Ijaz, of course, wanted her to convert to the Muslim religion, and she was just not, you know, she had grown up a Christian. She believed in it. She lived it. And she explained to him, I'm sorry, but if I did that, I would be false. It would be a false, you know, move, and I'm not going to do that to you, to your religion, to myself. And there were some other issues going on in the divorce. And of course, in between was their child, which they had shared custody after the divorce, but nonetheless, and there was some fighting, but there was never hitting. There were never hateful names. Voices raised, yes, it's one of those typical, you know, breakups where one person doesn't want to break up, the other one says it's best we do, for various reasons, that for the privacy of his wife, I'm not going into, but it had nothing to do with Ijaz. Now, Ijaz and his wife are arguing, and finally, they have the legal divorce. And of course, both are very torn because they do love one another, but it, you know, his wife felt this is what we need to do to be honest to one another. and they divorce, but they share custody of the son, and they remain friends. So the son is crazy about his father. His father teaches him how to run a cash register, how to count inventory, how to prosper, how to make something of yourself. And from a very early age, he's teaching his son these things. Ijaz opened a business in a local shopping mall, and he sold items from Pakistan. And he would go to Pakistan once a year, and he would buy, purchase, collect items, and then he'd return to the States and sell them in his store. And he would sell trinkets and clothing and various items that were truly from his country. And one of the things he sold were swords. So Ijaz is living in Memphis alone, because Muslims aren't supposed to live with a woman that is not a wife. But yet he's got this hole in his heart. Mm-hmm. Along comes the fellow who works on Ijaz's car. And he shows up one day at Ijaz's door, and there's a pretty white female with him. Blonde hair, big eyes, quiet, calm. And he says to Ijaz, he says, she has nowhere to live and nowhere to stay. She's living on the street. Her husband beat her. He took the children and ran. She just needs somewhere to live. Well, Ijaz, of course, believing in assist your community, he says, well, I have a rental house, because he owns several rental properties by now. And he says, I have a rental house that she could stay in for free until she gets on her feet. The woman's name is Leah Ward. So Leah thanks him and goes to live in this rental house.
Okay.
But what the mechanic and Leah don't explain to Ijaz is Leah just got out of prison. She does have a place to live. She's staying in a halfway house because she is on parole. She does have an ex-husband, but they're still legally married. And he didn't take the kids because she dumped them on him. And she was very cruel to the kids. And she was cruel to her ex-husband. A lot of yelling at him, a lot of hitting. She was just a very unpleasant individual. Now, Leah grew up in a very small town outside of Memphis, Tennessee. And it seems as though Leah had problems since she was young. She rebelled against her family. They were raised, you know, devout Christians. She rebelled against those values. She rebelled against the family. And soon enough, she becomes involved in drug dealing. So Leah finds herself in Memphis. She gets caught up drug dealing, goes to prison.
Oh, okay.
So
now, was this out of necessity, just to, you know, try to survive, or was this just a ne'er-do-well who fell in bad and stayed bad?
I think Leah was looking for some excitement. I think Leah liked to use drugs, and she just got carried away. You know, if you saw the little town where she's from, and then you saw the, you know, city of Memphis, in my opinion, who would not want to go to Memphis? I love Memphis. I love that town. I know a lot of people don't. But she saw excitement and men and the streets and the drugs and the carousing. Okay, this is for me. Instead of this little one horse, not even a stoplight town.
Right.
Well, Leah dumps the kids on her ex-husband. She dumps the ex-husband. They are still legally married. And she moves to Memphis. And then she winds up in prison. Now she's on parole, and she's, quote unquote, friends with this mechanic. Now, from what I understand, he was possibly her pimp, but I can't prove that. So I don't want to say that she was on the street.
Okay. All right.
So fast forward.
Leah, but that was what was being theorized at the time. Do you believe
correct.
That, and I know you have to be very cautious on this, but I mean, do you believe that there was probably some truth to that rumor?
Possibly. And okay. I'll tell you why a little later in the story. It gets very interesting.
Okay.
So Leah is living in Ijaz's house for free. And Ijaz is bringing her food. And she says, I really want to be a nurse. That's my goal. That's my dream. I just want to settle down and be a nurse and help people. Well, the house that Leah is staying in is in a sketchy part of Memphis. And Ijaz contacts her and says, I don't want you staying in that house because it's not a good neighborhood for a single lady. You can use my house and I'll move out and live with a friend. Well, Ijaz had a nice house. It wasn't a mansion. It wasn't, you know, a two-story huge with the columns in front. It was a simple house in a medium to high income neighborhood. Mm-hmm. It was decorated very nicely. That's another thing Ijaz was good at, is he was a very good at colors and style. So Leah is thinking, well, here's a free house and it's nice and it has all the amenities and it's decorated nicely. Why not?
Right.
And who am I? Right. So Leah moves into that house. Ijaz moves out because, again, it's against his religion to live with a lady that is not married to him. He's still bringing her food and he still checks in on her.
So Ijaz, I mean, he sounds like a prince among men. I mean, he's willing to go out of his way and even sacrifice his own comfort and happiness in order to help other people. Amazing guy. Is Leah somebody that he's feeling attracted to in some way? What is this overwhelming need and desire to help the stranger?
A lot of it is his faith. A lot of it is his faith because, again, you know, him being Muslim, you help your neighbor and you help people in need. And far from the terrorist, the evil person, the one that beats the women, you know, right. I studied a lot about Muslims when I wrote this book. I studied the religion. I read part of the Quran. And if you said everyone from the Middle East was a terrorist or evil or treats women bad, that's like saying Tim McVeigh, being blonde-haired, blue-eyed, represents all men.
Right. Right. That it's just this. You're right. They paint Muslims with one broad stroke, and because of some of more extremist versions, it's as though they all get lumped together. And, you know, as Tim points out to me all the time, there's extremists in every religion and every race and creed. So, yeah, that should be straightened up. But all right, he is this kind man. He does this. But again, so there's no other ulterior motive for him. And she's lucked into a gold mine situation for herself.
She's hit a double gold mine. And, you know, Ijaz wasn't a perfect man. Nobody is. Nobody's a perfect person. But he believed in doing good. So he is running his store in the mall. He has a rental house program going on where he's got several properties in Memphis. And he's doing little odd jobs in between. Ijaz stayed busy. He did not drink. He did not smoke. He, of course, did not do any kinds of drugs. He was very adamant that nobody around him do those things. Now, I should say he also had a good friend who had often lived on the street in and out, and he helped him. Even if his friend had to sleep on an air mattress, you know, in the house, he was out of the weather, and he wasn't on the street wondering where the next meal is. Ijaz took care of him, too.
Wow, sweet guy. All right. This sounds like the kind of guy who should have just a great life because of who he is and how he lives his life.
Yeah, and you know, everyone I talk to, and I talk to a lot of people, friends, family, friends of friends, people who worked alongside him, not one of them could say anything about Ijaz having ulterior motives, being a bad person, doing bad things. He, for one thing, he was too busy. He was working all his businesses. He didn't believe in you know, alcohol, smoking, drinking. He wouldn't touch it, and he didn't want it around him. So here's Ijaz taking care of Leah and you know, his friend when his friend drops into town, and probably a couple of other people along the way. And finally, he tells Leah, We've seen a lot of each other. We get along. What if we got married? And of course, Leah jumps at it. And again, Ijaz isn't rich. He lives well.
Yeah.
He has prosperous businesses, and he is a good man. Hmm. So Leah sees a dollar sign.
Right.
She doesn't bother saying, oh, well, I can't because I'm already married. Or, you know, I lied about my kids. Or, oh, by the way, I'm on parole. She doesn't tell him any of these things. So they get married in the Muslim ceremony. Occasionally, she does wear the hijab. And suddenly, she's all interested in the Muslim religion. So they're married. They're living in Ijaz's house. And she's still telling him, I just dream of being a nurse. Finally, Ijaz says, well, then why don't you follow your dreams? And he puts her in nursing school. So Leah is packing her little backpack and she's going to nursing school. And she tells Ijaz how much she loves it and how good it is for her. However, there's a secret again behind Leah's nursing school. She is rarely going to school. And when she packed her little backpack, she is stealing inventory from Ijaz for his store.
Unbelievable.
So all she does, and she's trading it for dope, or she's pawning it for money. Mm. Oh, by the way, if you helped me, I think my kids would be able to visit me.
Right.
Now, here's something that I found interesting. And he still calls her his mother-in-law, and he's still good friends with the family and his ex-wife, and they all share the son together. In other words, they're all raising him together.
Right.
And the mother-in-law comes in, and here's Leah crashed out on the couch, dead asleep. And she says, who is that, Ijaz? And he says, oh, I want you to meet Leah. Leah wakes up. The mother-in-law says, hi, how are you? I'm named. Leah could not have cared less. And there was something about her character. There was something about the way she looked or didn't look. She would avoid her eyes. And the mother-in-law says, something isn't right about this woman. And she pulls Ijaz aside and says, Ijaz, do you really know what you're doing here? Do you really want to do this? And Ijaz says, yes, I do. Well, Ijaz introduces Leah to his ex-wife when they pick up their son, his son.
Okay.
And the ex-wife says, walks out to the car because Leah wouldn't get out of the car. And Leah rolls down the window and she says, hi, I'm Name. I'm our son's wife and Ijaz's ex. And she puts out her hand. Leah sticks out her hand. And when she shakes the ex-wife's hand, she scrapes her with her nails on her palm. And she says, oh, hello. Well, the way she avoided eye contact, her body language, everything, the ex-wife tells Ijaz, what are you doing? There's something about her that isn't right. Oh, no, no, you don't understand. She lived on the street. She didn't have anyone. I helped her get on her feet. You know, he explains the story.
Mm-hmm.
And the ex-wife is like, no, Ijaz, there's something beyond her. She's up to something. Well, Ijaz didn't want to believe anything bad about Leah. Now, is it because who he was? Is it because he just didn't want to hear it? You know, who knows? But he stays with Leah despite everyone disliking her. Now, his friend that occasionally came along, he thought Leah was okay, but he witnessed a lot of things he didn't like. And Ijaz's son liked her because she went out of her way to take care of him. Lo and behold, Leah's kids get to visit her. And when Leah's kids are there, she includes Ijaz's son as well. But there are issues. For one example, they're very small kids. They're 6 years old. They're 8 years old. And she says, how about going to the mall? Sure. Everybody piles in the car. Everybody goes to the mall. They get out of the car and into the mall. And she says, okay, I'll pick you up in an hour right here, and leaves them. So here are three little kids. Mm. I'd say an estimate between 4 and 8 years old, wandering the mall together.
So yikes.
They meet her back. She takes them, puts them in the car, and back home they go. When Ijaz hears this, he hits the ceiling. You let little kids walk the mall, no money, no anything, while you went where? No, they're lying. I was with them. My son doesn't lie. He's very truthful. No, I was there. Big row, a lot of yelling. Well, as time goes by, Ijaz is starting to see it in Leah. And his bank account, there's just money missing that he doesn't know where it went. There are items in his inventory in the house that don't seem to be there when he needs to put them in his store. And Leah is very cagey when she's asked, are you going to school? Well, wait a minute. Why aren't you in school? Why are you at home sleeping? What happened at school today? No answer. So Ijaz starts thinking, you know what? Something's cagey here. Something's not right. Because on the nights Leah's supposed to go to school, there she is in bed.
Right.
Or she won't answer him. So Ijaz starts saying, what is going on here? Nothing. You're just suspicious. And the fights would start. And it got to where, when the fights would start, Leah starts hitting. And she shoves him, and she punches him, and she hits him. Well, Ijaz does not raise his hands except to defend himself. Palms forward, no fists. And he's saying, you know, stop hitting me and stop acting like this. And his son witnessed an incident where they were on the couch watching a movie. Leah comes in, words are exchanged, and she literally shoves him to where he falls back into the couch.
Yikes.
So here we go with, you know, Leah doing these things, acting like this, hitting,
now, are there no friends? Is there, I mean, there's nobody that knows Leah any other way that might have had some insight on this to tell him?
The only connection he had to Leah was the mechanic that introduced them. And according to the mechanic, she's a good girl. She's just had some hard times. She's on the street and she just needs a place to live. They knew what to do. They knew what buttons to push. They knew how to work Ijaz.
So this is kind of a conspiratorial grouping, these two. They knew what they were doing. They knew how to get over on this guy and what they were going to be able to do to milk him as much as they could.
No doubt. No doubt.
Heartbreaking. Absolutely heartbreaking.
Now, here's something else interesting. I interviewed Leah's buddy and drug dealer, and he liked Leah. I have a suspicion that it's because people who are involved in that lifestyle stick together, even though they're not true friends. Do you see where I'm going, or what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Okay. Because he had his stint locked up too.
Right.
And when Leah would stay with them, it was never anything sexual. It was strictly friendship. And he liked Leah. He thought she was funny. He thought she had a good heart. You know, he had nothing bad to say about Leah. So back to Ijaz's house. Now we're in his house and we're listening to all of this, the fighting and the screaming, her calling names, her being, you know, where she's not supposed to be. But one night, Ijaz's ex-wife says, you know what? I'm going to follow that bitch. I'm going to see what's going on. So she does. She gets in her car and she hides out, and she finds Leah standing on a corner of a very questionable neighborhood in Memphis, dressed, quote, the wife, like a slut. That's interesting.
Yeah, it certainly is. Now, so she's, you know, obviously, do you question the, you know, the principal involved in this? Is she maybe overjudging? You know, so I could see why there might be some question as to where the information is coming from.
Oh, sure. One thing about this family, and they've become my second family, One thing about them is they're honest people. They know their flaws and they'll tell you. Her mother, the ex-wife's mother and Ijaz's mother-in-law, she actually worked in law enforcement way back in the day at this little town. Her husband was the sheriff, and it was sort of like, hey, you want to be, you know, a sheriff's deputy? Sure. Okay, here's a gun and a badge. And that's how it was back then.
Okay.
She lived through race riots.
Mm-hmm.
She is a devout Christian. She was, you know, they were friends with this one family. And typical Southern style, they pull up in the front yard. This was, again, back in the day. And her daddy would call out to the man of the house and say, hey, you old son of a bitch. And he'd answer back, hey, you old son of a bitch. And then they'd hug and say, how are you? And all of this. They had a little, this family that were friends with them, they had a little boy named Elvis. And it was the Presley family.
No way.
Yes. She, wow. I tell you, I want to tell her she needs to write a book because she is, she's got, and she even told me, she goes, oh, honey, I got stories and I can talk the horns off a billy goat. She's just, she's in her 90s now. She's just amazing. I adore her.
Wow.
And I love that family like my own. And I'm very, very protective of the surviving victims right. in my work. So nonetheless, we're going to fast forward to Ijaz's house again.
Mm-hmm.
Here's Leah doing these things, acting like this. And finally, again, Ijaz is checking his bank account. There's no money, you know, in where it needs to be. And he's thinking, okay, I think she's stealing from me. And he even told a friend, he said, she's stealing from me. I have figured out what's going on and she's stealing. And he was just aghast. He was just aghast. So he confronts Leah. Of course, he's just being paranoid. There's a lot of yelling. There's a lot of accusations. There's a lot of hitting on Leah's part. And finally, the big straw. Leah comes into Ijaz one morning and says, I have to go check in somewhere. Where do you have to check in? An office. What office? I got a letter in the mail and I need to go check in. What is the letter? I'm on parole.
Oh.
Ijaz hits the ceiling. What are you on parole for? Dealing drugs. What? What? Parole? That means you were in prison. And drugs? What if I said about drugs not being... So, okay, Leah has become everything Ijaz does not believe in. However, she is his wife, and he feels the need to still protect. So he climbs in a car with Leah. They pick up Leah's mother, and they all go to the parole office and let Leah check in. Ijaz refuses to get out of the car. I'm not going in there. I'm not supporting you in this. Leah checks in with her parole. She comes back, and Ijaz is just steaming, thinking this is going south real quick, and not the good south like Texas. Okay.
Right.
So he finally tells Leah, look, you have got to leave. You've got to leave. And, you know, at one point, Ijaz goes to a Christmas party with Leah's family. And he meets the ex-husband. And they shake hands. And Ijaz says, I've heard very bad things about you. And the ex-husband's thinking, what? Wait, what? Because, again, there are no perfect people. But he was a good guy.
Right.
Cared about his kids. About Leah. And, you know, I still think he might carry a torch for Leah.
Huh.
He won't get a divorce. And there are just some things that I watched when we were talking, and I thought, he still carries a little bit. It might be
Wait a minute. What do you mean he won't get a divorce? I thought that Ijaz was married to her.
He is.
But she is not divorced from her ex-husband yet?
Nope.
Wow. What?
Yep.
Holy cow.
Leah is legally married to her quote-unquote ex-husband. She's also married to Ijaz. It was a Muslim ceremony. Mm-hmm. It was a, I guess you'd call it a typical or a Christian, what, however you want to phrase it.
Right.
She had that wedding to her ex-husband. And then she has the Muslim wedding with Ijaz. I mean, this girl is just playing all over the place. Mm. So...
And there's a good chance that she's out prostituting as well through all of this.
Oh, yeah. And she's stealing from him left and right. She's pawning his things. She's taking them and trading them to everyone. By now, Ijaz has closed the store, so he's got a lot of inventory in the house.
All right. How does this continue to unravel? God, what a tangled web. You think... How do people not see these red flags from the beginning? It's real easy on the outside for all of us, right, to be sitting here shaking our head. But, you know, you just wonder, do we really keep that blind an eye to somebody that we love so that we don't feel foolish that we weren't taken?
They tried to tell him. And Ijaz is still best buddies with his ex-wife. And he shows up at his ex-wife's work and says, "She's stealing from me." And she said, "Ijaz, you've got to get out of here. You've got to get out of this relationship. She's going to do something bad, or she's going to, you know, steal you out of house and home. And, you know, you're going to be left with a light bulb dangling from the ceiling." So she's trying to talk him out of it. His ex-mother-in-law is trying to talk him out of it. "You've got to get out of here, Ijaz." So Ijaz tells someone, "She is evil. That woman is evil. She is evil." And that's the last thing anyone who loved Ijaz heard him say.
Oh, no. All right.
So finally, in May of 2003, Ijaz tells Leah, "Look, you've got to go. You've got to get out of here. I can't do this anymore. But I'm not going to throw you on the street." He gives her a bunch of money. He takes her to one of the better motels downtown Memphis. And it's goodbye, good riddance, see you when wanna be ya. Leah is furious. How dare he? The next thing you know, Leah's breaking into his house and stealing. And, of course, Ijaz is, again, beside himself. You've got to stop breaking into my house. You know, you've got to stop stealing. And, you know, get your raunchy friends out of here. Because that's another thing she would do, is bring these scary-looking people around. So, finally, showdown time. Ijaz and Leah are arguing. And Ijaz has a gun. He told everyone that he needed it for protection because he did have so many nice things in the house. It was Memphis after all. However, he kept that gun way high on a shelf away from the kids. Now, I know that sounds, you know, gun owners are I'm a gun owner. And anytime a kid wants to find something, they're going to find it.
Exactly.
But he also talked to his son and explained to him the dangers, and he was never to touch it, and he was, you know, not to go near it. And his son, okay, sure, because his dad was his hero. Ijaz's son just worshipped his daddy. His daddy taught him, as a matter of fact, he told me, "My dad taught me so much in life. So many good things." So, there's an argument. The next thing you know, Leah's got a gun. And it's Ijaz's gun that she has kept hidden. And she says to Ijaz, you know, "I'm not leaving, I'm out of here," whatever she says to him. And she whips out the gun. And Ijaz, ballistics have proven, Ijaz stood there with his hands up. Nowhere near her. And she shoots him. Now, it was an accident, and she felt horrible. And there he lay dying, and as he lay dying, he recited a Muslim prayer. So now Leah is in a house with a body, a dead body. What is she going to do? She drags Ijaz into the bathroom and closes the door. And his son would call and say, is my dad there? Oh, no, he's not here. He's picking up a car. Okay, have him call me. A couple of days later, ring. Hello, is my daddy there? No, he's gone to pick up some things. We'll have him call me, you know, when he gets there. The next thing you know, the ex-wife is calling. Let me talk to Ijaz. This is so unlike him to not talk to his son. And Leah blows her off. Now, according to her neighbors that I spoke with, Leah's having parties. She's having all these parties with all these people. And Ijaz is laying dead in the bathroom. So she starts telling people.
People are at the house partying and they don't know that there's a dead man in the bathroom.
No.
Good God.
It's a dead rat in the wall. It's the sewer is broken up. It's the sewer is backed up. Finally, Leah tells Ijaz's son and Ijaz's ex-wife, she says, oh, he went to Pakistan. He's going to be gone for a long time. Now, this is wrong because everybody knows when Ijaz goes to Pakistan, one, he's going to tell everybody who loves him. Two, he's going to spend time with his son before he goes. Ijaz has gone to Pakistan. No. Yes, he did. Then Leah tells the son, I think I'll move to Florida. I don't know. And shave my head. And the son is like, what? So finally, Ijaz's ex-mother-in-law, who's the one I told you, she is a spitfire. She says, I am tired of this craziness. I'm tired of Leah telling lies because we know it's lies. Ijaz wouldn't go to Pakistan. And I'm tired of this whole show. I'm going over there and seeing what's going on. Ijaz's son says, Grandma, can I go? So the both of them get in the car and head for Ijaz's house. Again, another interesting time for them because she's sick of Leah's BS. And she is going to confront her. They get to the house. She bangs on the front door. Leah, I know you're in there. Well, she and the son go to the windows and peer in. This house is empty. They go around back and they're looking at the backyard. What is going on? This backyard is trashed. There's junk. There's trash. There's trash bags haven't been taken out. Nothing like what Ijaz would do. Because again, he was a very clean, fastidious guy and he liked things to look nice. What happened? Well, the son had a pet chicken and the chicken's running around loose, which is very strange. And he says, well, can at least I need to at least catch my chicken. And the chicken's name was Penny. He says, I at least need to catch Penny and take her home with us, Grandma. Can I? And she said, well, yeah, sure. So he's running around catching the chicken and the chicken runs, you know, to where he can't get to her. And he is near the garage door and he says, ugh, what is that smell? And the grandmother walks up to the garage door and she says, oh, my God, it's got to be a dead rat or animal or something that was trapped in there. Now, what? It's so against Ijaz to have this going on in his garage. It was a storage shed.
So it's not crossing their minds at all that it could be Ijaz because that's just far removed, even though he's vanished. Nobody knows where he's gone, what he's doing, and it's kind of out of his normal wheelhouse of personality.
Right. Now, okay. Take a thought here. You and I, being in the business we're in, that's what we would think. Cops, firemen, people who, you know, like to watch, you know, True Crime Miami or True Crime Mule Sheep, whatever, you know, people who kill people next door who have an orange hat, those kind of shows. Right away, they would be like, what is going on? So they open the garage door and there lays a body.
Oh.
And it's nude. And right away, they know who it is. So his son witnesses this. So they run over across the street. They bang on the door of a neighbor and they tell her, there's a body in the garage. We think it's Ijaz. Please call 911. Ijaz had been beheaded.
Oh. So this woman is evil, doesn't even come close to an accurate description to what this woman really is.
Well, here's an interesting point. When a Muslim dies, they have to be buried within so many hours, and they have to be wrapped in, it's a very, you know, it's a process. They have to be wrapped in linen a certain way. They have to be where their head is pointing toward Mecca. And so it's very important to be buried whole.
Right.
And it's very important to be buried so many hours and wrapped a certain way and laid in a grave and such, a Muslim cemetery, so to speak. So the police arrive. They inspect the crime scene. We have a headless body. We have no way of identifying this person, really, you know, and Ijaz's ex-wife shows up, and she's just so frantic, and she's saying, I can identify him if you want. Just show me his face. Did he have dark hair? Did he have brown eyes? No, ma'am. We cannot let you into a crime scene. So now Ijaz's loved ones are sitting in a car parked across the street.
Wait a minute. The police won't let her look. They have a crime scene. They don't know who's there, but they're not going to give somebody a chance to identify the body. That seems counterproductive.
They had a naked, headless body, and they honestly didn't know who these people were. Now, okay. Ijaz's ex-mother-in-law is saying, I know it's him, I know it's him. But really, you can't identify somebody based on, you know, what they were going to see as speculation. They don't know who these people are, and they don't know how close to Ijaz they are. They could be suspects for all they know.
All right. So yeah, I guess it's just strange. You're right. I know on that. I'm just thinking, boy, you'd want, as law enforcement, you kind of want an answer and resolve things pretty quickly. And if somebody's there claiming, I might know who that is. But I guess, you know, again, we're thinking from a different perspective because you don't realize how many nut bars are out there that just want to go see a dead body.
Oh, God, yes.
Yeah.
So, you know, who's their suspect? And right away, they're telling the cops, Leah Ward. It's Leah Ward. Well, you're trying to process a crime scene. And you're trying to process a very grisly crime scene. You don't know who this is. You don't know who these people are. You know, first thing is first. They've got to collect the body. They've got to take photographs. Ijaz had deteriorated so that the hand, the epidermis on the hand had slipped off, which is prone to do
Gosh, right.
The coroner arrives. And he says, what is this on the ground? And he realizes what it is. It's glove-like, and it's a hand, and it has slipped off the body. So what he does to preserve evidence is he puts on a glove, a rubber, you know, glove, and he slips his hand into the slipped-off skin. So he's wearing the hand like a glove, and they preserve evidence. And sure enough, they get perfect prints off that hand, the skin from that hand.
Oof.
They process the body, they identify it as Ijaz, and now they're looking for Leah Ward because they want to question her. And they've questioned close family members and friends. They went to the mosque and they questioned Ijaz's friends. And of course, everyone is just so overwhelmed by this. Who would kill Ijaz Ahmad? So then they start looking for this Leah person because she is the wife and she's the only person they haven't questioned. I mean, what's going on here? You know, they find her, and they find her because she has checked in with parole. And parole says, okay, we're going to drug test you. Uh-oh. Leah had a negative drug test, so off to prison, you're going back. So they finally locate Leah, and they take her to downtown Memphis and sit her down and question her. And Leah breaks down and tells the truth. She says, I shot him. I shot him because he was attacking me. He was hitting me. He was beating me. And I had to, you know, protect myself. Leah is now wearing handcuffs. Let's fast forward to the trial. For the first appearance in court, Leah shows up and she is bald as an eagle. She has clipped her hair off, sometimes to the skin, little bitty tufts sticking out everywhere. And one of the things she does in the courtroom is throw herself on the floor crying. So eventually Leah is found guilty and she lands in prison, the women's prison, which is in Nashville. And she was interviewed on a show that's one of the popular shows on TV. And who knows what it was like, you know, women who kill women who wear knickers. I don't know. It was one of those shows. So Leah is interviewed. And she told the television person that she was beaten because you know how Middle Easterns are. And he beat her and he was ugly to her and called her names.
And well, she's going the burning bed route. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Now, what angered me is this show didn't even do research on what really happened. They let Leah tell her story in her little girl voice. And now everybody thinks Ijaz Ahmad is not only an evil terrorist Muslim, but of course he beats his wife. And Leah is sticking to the story. And today, she remains in a prison in Tennessee, and Ijaz could not be buried as a true Muslim. Oh. Here's what upset me, and one of the reasons I wrote this book is because the DA, the district attorney, wasn't even sure they could take this to trial because at the time, the feeling against Muslims and anybody from the Middle East.
Right. But obviously it fell against her. And even with the case the way it was, they found her guilty of this crime. How long did the case go on?
I don't even know the answer to that right now.
Okay.
Shit.
No problem. No, well, I know it's been a while for you. I was just curious, but she goes to jail. Do you know how long she's sentenced for?
Life.
Life. Okay. Crazy. That's just heartbreaking. And again, for a guy who did nothing but go out of his way to help people and try to be kind. And this is the thanks he gets. What an absolute heartbreak and tragedy. She is evil. Madness and murder in Memphis. Judith, you've had a chance to speak to the people in this. Did you ever get a chance to talk to Leah Ward?
I spent at least 3 years on this book. Pulling records, research, running around Memphis, interviewing people. Now, I did write to Leah as she was writing me back. And I said, you know, I want to tell your story. I want to tell your side of it. Well, she was all for that. And I sent her a release to interview because I don't interview anyone without their legal permission, especially an inmate. Well, I don't know if she saw in the release that she doesn't get any money from this. You know, she's not going to get paid money on her books. No true crime author pays anyone for a story. Well, let's put it this way. No true crime author that follows the rules. And I'll just say that.
Right.
So anyway, so I sent her this release to be interviewed. And it says, you know, you're not going to gain any money out of this. She sent it back tore up, just shredded, and she writes on it, on the envelope, "I don't approve of this book." So I gave it a while, and I sent her another release and said, "Okay, Leah, this is your last chance to tell me your story. I'm not judge and jury. I'm not, you know, buddy-buddy with any side. I want to know your story." And again, I get a shredded letter in the mail. Okay. Now, I started getting really weird emails from people I don't know about Leah's innocence. And at one point, I had to have the police watching my house on a regular basis because it just got weird. Well, it happens a lot with my books. The perpetrator is innocent, or I'm profiting off of grief, or I'm doing this, or a percentage of this book is done to a charity.
We're losing you. We're getting a bad connection here as we're wrapping up on the interview. So it's crackling on you. I heard you say a percentage of the sales of this book goes to a charity, but we didn't hear what or if I'm even getting that proper. Sam, are you there?
I'm here.
All right. I think somehow we've lost our guest. Very strange. Came at the best part of the show, I guess, though. At least we've wrapped up the story and have heard the end of this. What a tragedy, man. This story hits and hurts in so many ways. You know, the disrespect, the pure disregard for humanity, somebody that stooped to help you and lift you up and give you a home and give you a life and take care of you and try to help you see your dreams through to be a nurse, do these things. Not only do they end up murdering you, but they behead you to mess up your proper and respectful burial. It's just such a tragedy in every possible way. It's, I don't know, man, this is a tough story.
It's the lying and then the desecration that really is the knife in the gut at the end. And then to play it off in the media as you're completely innocent and then spin everything to make it seem like he was an evil man. That's the real tragedy.
It's heart wrenching. Yeah. Just disgusting.
Yeah.
Amazing story. The book is out and available. She Is Evil: Madness and Murder in Memphis. We have a link up for that book on today's program guide. All right, it's time to clear the mental palate, if you will. Let's shake it off. It's time now. Dumb Crimes and Stupid Criminals.
It's Crayon News story time.
What happened with this dude, Christ Bearer? I heard he cut his penis off and then jumped off a balcony.
Suspect pulls gun from butt, shoots twice at Denver police.
What is your emergency?
Hello, I need help.
And what's the problem?
I'm too high.
You're too high?
Yeah.
All right, Tim, as promised, Dumb Crimes, Stupid Criminals, and we've got one from right here in our own backyard.
We do.
Yeah. I mentioned this. This is kind of a disturbing one. A TSA employee at Minneapolis St. Paul Airport has been accused of taking photos of young female travelers.
Ooh.
Yeah. A federal security employee at the Minneapolis St. Paul International Airport, already in trouble for taking video of a young boy riding a luggage carousel, is also accused of taking dozens of photos of young females during pre-flight screening. The discovery was made during an investigation into an incident involving a 9-year-old boy taking an unauthorized ride on a baggage claim conveyor belt on May 1st. That investigation led to Bjorn Broms of Savage being charged Monday in Hennepin County District Court with violation of government data practices, which is a misdemeanor. Broms was charged in connection with the conveyor belt allegation and awaits first court date. Reached by phone Tuesday, Broms declined to comment about the allegations. The criminal complaint alleges that 42 photos of females taken by the TSA agent shows them on the closed circuit monitor in various forms of dress, such as shorts, tight pants, and tank tops. In reference to the conveyor belt incident, the complaint says that Brahms recorded videos from closed-circuit imagery of the boy climbing onto the baggage conveyor belt behind a Delta ticket counter and going for a brief ride. Airport police found the youngster unharmed. Brahms then sent video footage of the boy's unauthorized excursion to the Minnesota Public Radio, which posted the imagery on its website. A fellow TSA agent told an airport detective that she heard Brahms say, "I should sell this to the news. I could make quite a bit of money." That's what the charging document said. A statement from TSA said the veteran employee has been put on administrative leave as the investigation continues. Creepy.
Here's a little tip for you kids out there in TV land. You don't make anything from the news for that type of footage. They don't buy that. No.
No. Unless it's like destructive, something horrific happening, not just these little, there's a kid taking a ride on a conveyor belt.
Oh, they don't even do that. They don't buy footage. They'll take it from you.
I don't believe that. I believe that there are outlets that pay for footage.
They don't. Footage. Like the tabloids will pay for stuff like that, but not legitimate.
Really?
Yeah, legitimate.
So if I caught a tornado touching down, mm-hmm. tearing up my neighborhood.
Yep.
And I caught the actual footage and offered it to CBS, NBC. They'd go, just give us the footage, man, or we're going to break some legs.
No, they don't even do that. They'll say, well, sure, we'll gladly take that footage if you'll offer it to us, but we don't pay for footage. Not a legitimate news source will not pay for footage.
Here's our second air-related story, Tim. And having just had to fly quite a bit,
mm-hmm.
this one I understand because I always end up sitting next to the bathroom. No matter what seat I pick, they think they've done me a favor by upgrading me or moving me, and I always have to sit next to the bathroom. A Seattle woman said a flight attendant forced her to remove a dirty diaper from an airplane trash bin and later told her she was being placed on a no-fly list for creating a biohazard.
What?
Yeah. The incident happened while the 34-year-old endocrinologist, Dr. Farah Khan, two different words, Dr. Farah
right.
Khan, not right. Dr. Farrakhan. I just right. want to clarify
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
Louis Farrakhan did not get arrested for putting dirty
diaper. Yeah.
No, this is Dr. Farah Khan,
yeah.
was traveling from Montana to Texas with her husband and young daughter on Friday. The flight was operated and staffed by Arizona-based Mesa Airlines, a United Express airline regional partner. Khan said the conflict began after she changed the toddler's diaper and disposed of the dirty one in the scented bag, which she then threw in a bathroom trash bin. When I came to the front, the flight attendant berated me for throwing away a poop diaper on a plane, she said in a series of tweets over the weekend. She said it was a biohazard and that I should retrieve it if I can. So there I am, fishing a poop diaper out of the back bathroom. The woman said she later asked a different flight attendant for an extra garbage bag so she could keep the dirty diaper with her during the rest of the trip. But the second crew member told her she had done nothing wrong and should have disposed of the diaper in the bathroom, according to Khan. She then went back to the first flight attendant to confront him, but he yelled at me again and said he didn't want to deal with me, according to her tweets. The flight apparently proceeded without further incident, but Khan's interactions with the angry crew member were far from over. 3 hours after the flight landed in Houston, the same Mesa flight attendant called her from a 1-800 number to tell her she'd been placed on a no-fly list. That's crazy. And he cursed out me and my family, Khan said, suggesting the man may have targeted her because of her race. She told local media on Monday that she's a third-generation South Asian American and a Muslim. The unidentified flight attendant went on to say, "You people bring your families everywhere. You should stop flying and just drive. I hear your obnoxious baby in the background right now," Khan said on Twitter. United Airlines said Khan has not been placed on a no-fly list, despite the crew member's alleged claim. The company has also been in touch with the mom since the incident, United Airlines spokesperson Maddie King told the Daily News. Mesa Airlines said it was investigating the incident and its flight attendants' actions. The details as described by our customer do not meet the high standards that Mesa sets for our flight attendants. We're reviewing the matter. Many Twitter users reacted in shock to Khan's allegations. That's right. First of all, what do you want me to do? Do you want me to take it back in the plane, a dirty poop smelling diaper, so that that smell just starts permeating the plane, or Ugh. Keep it in the closed bathroom? I will say this.
Ugh.
I have met some really unhinged flight attendants.
Yeah. Well,
hey, yeah. I've met some unhinged Cub grocery store and workers. So I don't want people to think I'm picking on airplanes or air staff. there's the majority of them are delightful, charming people. But when you get the one little Nazi that is so rude and obnoxious, like I was on a flight during filming of Holzer Files, mm-hmm. and I'm in an exit row, and I have the whole row to myself. So I sat in the middle so that I could put stuff on each seat on either side of me, you know, and, the woman comes along and I pop out my one earbud because I know I'm going to get the spiel about sitting in the exit row.
Yep.
And she's giving her speech and then looks at me and sees I still have one earbud in, and she just stops talking and like kind of tents her hands.
Mm-hmm.
And she's staring at me. And at this point, I don't know what she's staring at. And I'm like, is something wrong? She goes, I'm talking to you. Take out your goddamn earbud and Whoa. Pay attention.
Whoa.
And I just kind of looked, and then I looked over at the other side of the exit row, and all the people's eyebrows go super high. And I'm like, okay. And I popped the other earbud, and she goes, thank you. Now you're sitting in an exit row. Are you willing? And you know, I need a verbal yes. And she starts on the other side. Yes, yes. And she comes to me and I go, yep. She goes, I said, yes. Is it that hard to follow directions?
Wow.
And I just, at that point, I just stared at her and I refused to respond. And she goes, I need a verbal. And I said, yep. And she just glares at me. Now, I understand I could have been an adult myself and just said yes to appease her. Yeah. But I was like, who the flip are you? Yeah. I'm TV's Dave Schrader. I am an American treasure. You don't speak to me this way. No, that's not what it was. But I just thought, really, who the hell are you? Then she comes through. And, you know, I put everything away during taxiing. We mm-hmm. take off. I put a couple things out on the seat. She comes by and she goes, you need to put these away. And I go, why? She goes, because they can't be out. And I said, you just said they can't be out during taxiing and landing, and I'll put them away. I said they need to be put away. Is there going to be a problem here? And again, I just kind of look around at the people around me because I'm kind of embarrassed because she's making such a stink of it. And they're all kind of shaking their head like, what the fuck? And I go, I think the only problem is you. I'll put my stuff away, but I paid to be here. You need to treat me with a little bit more respect. Speaking politely would get things done a lot faster. She goes, don't tell me how to do my job. I said, somebody should. And then Whoa. She storms off. They come down my row. She's the one handing out drinks. Refuses to make eye contact with me. Doesn't offer me a drink. Doesn't offer me nuts. Nothing. Just pushes past. And that's when they just had the little zip bags that they were handing you with the little mini bottle of water and like prepackaged nuts already in it.
Yep.
Didn't even offer it to me.
Hmm.
I contacted the airlines and told them about this. And they're like, what was her name? I'm like, I don't know. I didn't pay attention to her name. I just thought you should know. She was a short little woman. She was the only short little white woman on this flight that was a flight attendant. So that should narrow things down for you. And I said, but she was just extremely rude. And the airlines didn't seem to think that I should be even bringing it to their attention.
Hmm.
And I was just like, well, you know, as an employer myself and having had employees, I'd like to know if people that are representing my business are like this. And they're like, okay, thanks. And that was like the extent of that. But I've bumped into some of these flight attendants that just are wackadoodles. And I understand it's very few when you think of the thousands and tens of thousands of hours I've spent in the air in 53 years. You know, I can maybe say I've been inconvenienced by a dozen employees, and I'm always trying to be the one that's helpful. I'll try to help people put their bags in or pull them down and do things. But once in a while, you just run into that one little Nazi that just is a jerk to everybody. What are you doing in this position? If you don't like working with people, you know, you should become a house painter. You know, just go do something that doesn't entail communication with people. But like this knucklehead, I put you on a, first of all, that should be harassment as well. If you're calling me up to telling me you're putting me on a no-fly list because I disposed of a dirty diaper the proper way, this guy should be arrested and or at least fined for harassment.
Yeah, you know, there are different ways to communicate that, you know, first of all, you probably put a dirty diaper in the wrong place. And second, let's figure out how we can dispose of this thing and right. go about our day, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Not try to make an ass out of the people in right. the seats. Yeah. I've, like I said, they're very few and far between. So those of you that are flight attendants, you don't have to send me emails. I'm sure you're delightful. But I'm sure you've worked with some of these assholes from time to time and know exactly who I'm talking about.
Well, it's probably not like the good doctor has, you said, what, endocrinologist?
Yes.
Okay. Probably works a fair amount of hours, probably doesn't fly very often. I know my endocrinologist does not get out very often, mm-hmm. works a lot of hours, probably doesn't fly a whole lot, and probably doesn't know automatically where a dirty diaper goes on a plane.
She's a mother. She knows where dirty diapers go and garbage cans in the bathroom is the place to put them. I will tell you, dude, I will tell you something, Tim. I was on a Delta flight. I love Delta. Mm-hmm. That's my main,
I'm a big fan too. Yeah.
But they have done something horrible. I went to the back of the plane to go to the restroom.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what it was about this restroom. There was no room in this restroom, period. I had to have a sit down moment.
Oh,
if you will. The wall to the right of my knee and the sink to the left of my knee, there was, it couldn't have been more than 12 to 18 inches between the wall and the sink.
Jeez.
So when you sit down,
yeah,
my bits and pieces were up. There was no way to point stuff down because there was no room.
Ooh.
And you're so cramped in that I was unsure that I was going to get a, clean sweep, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
So I couldn't go because I was so uncomfortable with the fact that I felt compressed in this bathroom that I was afraid I was going to whiz all over. And secondly, I wasn't sure that, the back door was going to open right.
Right.
So it was whatever, Delta, whatever you've done to your bathrooms, stop it. It was a big plane. There's no reason for this shenanigans.
Well, they are compressing things or have
not the bathroom should be the one thing you don't compress. A man needs his room.
Right.
I know. Well, like, let's make it smaller so people don't poop. Then you just sit there farting on a plane. Yeah. And I don't want to be that guy either.
Well, they did make things smaller so they could get more seats in so they could sell more spaces. So
yeah,
I mean,
but not the bathrooms. That's the one seat you want to have room.
Right. But they did this.
There were people that made me look tiny.
Yeah.
And I don't know how they could get in that bathroom to even try to stand and pee. It was so
speaking
horrible.
As one of those people, it's pretty hard to do.
Unbelievable. Well, yeah, not saying you're larger than me.
I am.
Just with your leg in the boot, I don't think you could have gotten into this restroom.
I don't.
That's how small it was.
I don't deal a deuce on a plane. Yeah.
You know what's worse than opening up a bathroom door on a plane and the bathroom is rancid,
mm-hmm.
and you know you have to go in and you just go in and do a quick pee and wash your hands and open the door and there's like a 4 mile long line.
Yeah.
Waiting. And you're like all the way down. You're like, it wasn't me. That was in there before I got there. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry.
And you have to deal out the excuses and you shouldn't be the one, you know. And what hurts the most is the person who dealt it just walks out like nothing ever happened. They walk out with their head held high and their shoulders back like, that was me.
And they're giggling as you're making your way through the line apologizing for the scent they left behind.
Oh,
but
yeah,
I digress.
Yeah.
A suspect taunts cops by asking about the reward for her arrest, leads to her getting caught. Last week, the Tulsa Police Department used Facebook to ask the public Wednesday for help tracking down a woman named Lorraine Graves, who they suspected as an accessory in a March slaying of Eric Graves. When she responded to the Facebook post to ask about a reward, she was arrested. The TPD posted about Lorraine Graves on the weekly Most Wanted post Tuesday. The Tulsa Police Department is looking for information about the whereabouts of Lorraine Graves, the post read. Lorraine Graves is charged with accessory to murder. Detectives say she was involved in the city's 10th homicide of 2021, where Eric Graves was shot and killed at the St. Thomas Square Apartments. Two other suspects allegedly involved in the murder of Eric Graves, Jaden and Gabriel Hobson, have been charged with murder and are already being held in police custody. A normal person seeing a Facebook post from the police calling them a weekly most wanted would continue to quietly shelter in place. But Lorraine Graves was either insulted or taunting the police when she commented on the post using her real name, asking, where's the reward money at? Well, perhaps the reward money is hidden in the same place as Lorraine's brains, this article goes on to say. She was immediately warned by other commentators. Girl, you better stay off social media. They could track you, one person said. Ain't going to be funny when you get processed, said another. Unfortunately for Lorraine Graves, the Tulsa Police Department was also reading the comments. The TPD's next Facebook post read, "Weekly Most Wanted arrested after commenting on our post about her. On Wednesday, we posted Lorraine Graves as the Weekly Most Wanted for accessory to murder in the homicide of Eric Graves. Shortly after that, Lorraine Graves started commenting on our post asking about reward money. On 7/15/21, around 4:30 p.m., detectives with our fugitive warrants unit arrested Graves in North Tulsa near 36th Street and Garrison Avenue. Graves is charged with accessory to murder. Her bond is set at $500,000. This is an arrest, not a conviction. Graves seemed to be either smiling about her arrest or embarrassed about posting a comment that led to her capture. I'm going to show you the picture of this goofball, Tim, who's been arrested stupidly for posting. Hold on, let me pull up your account here. I'm going to show you this picture. Yeah, she might not be the brightest bulb on the tree.
Okay.
That's the look you give when you get arrested. Huh. Not real bright, huh?
Oh my, no. Yeah. You.
She's like smirking, like, oh, you caught me. You caught me.
You got me.
Taco Bell has entered the true crime genre for us now, Tim. We've had plenty of Burger King and McDonald's missteps.
Mm-hmm.
Taco Bell's like, oh, hold on. Taco Bell employee was arrested Monday in Nashville after she and her coworkers set off fireworks inside the restaurant, causing the building to catch fire as they watched from afar and accidentally locked themselves out. The incident occurred on July 5th at one of the fast food chain's locations in Tennessee's capital city, but the investigation into how the blaze began took a turn on July 8th when restaurant management called local fire investigators report that surveillance cameras captured their employees playing with fireworks inside of the establishment, according to the statement released Monday by the Nashville Fire Department. According to the surveillance footage, the employees can be seen locking the doors to the dining room to keep customers from entering the business. The fire department said in a statement, the video then shows the employees running around the inside of the store with fireworks in their hands. At one point in the video, the employees can be seen going into the men's bathroom, where they are out of sight for the camera for a short period of time before returning to the lobby and placing an item into a trash can near the front door, according to Nashville Fire Department. Employees are then seen using their cell phone cameras to record the trash can from the outside of the restaurant. The fire department said employees then realized they locked themselves out of the restaurant. The employees tried unsuccessfully to get back into the store. When the employees saw the trash can start to smoke, they called 911. The footage has not yet been released. Firefighters arrived on scene a short time later and were able to force their way into the restaurant to extinguish the flames. The Nashville Fire Department estimated that the fire caused more than $30,000 worth of damage to the inside of the restaurant. Investigators also found damage inside of the men's bathroom, where it appeared fireworks were ignited inside of the trash can. The restaurant's shift leader, 25-year-old Courtney Mays, was taken into custody on Monday and charged with felony aggravated arson. She's being held on a $5,000 bond at the Davidson County Jail in Nashville. Arson is one of the costliest human-made disasters, the Nashville Fire Department said in a statement. Arson indirectly contributes to increased insurance premiums, higher medical costs, lost jobs, lost income, and increased costs of services. Yeah, let's pay them $15 to $20 an hour to act like imbeciles in a restaurant. Huh. Tim, we worked for 9 years for $10 an hour.
Yeah.
In radio. These guys are making $15 an hour to blow off fireworks in a Taco Bell.
But we got to act like imbeciles for that $10 an hour. So
We did. You know. We still do. Yeah. Aha, jokes on them.
Yeah, jokes on. Uh-huh. But they get $5 an hour more.
How many times a day, Tim, are you getting calls about your car's warranty?
Too many.
You fed up with it?
Yeah.
Well, this story is going to do your heart good then, because that's because the feds have busted three brothers who were behind more than 45 million illegal robocalls, according to CBS. The brothers from New Jersey are going to have to pay $1.6 million in a settlement with the Federal Trade Commission as a result.
Wow.
Yeah. How about them apples? You like apples, Tim?
I love apples.
Them apples.
Can I get in on some of them apples?
Yeah. The FTC alleged that Joseph, Sean, and Raymond Carney, of course, initiated more than 45 million illegal telemarketing calls to people across the country between 2018 and 2019 to sell a line of septic tank cleaning products. The free information deal quickly turned into a sales pitch. Those who wound up buying the products, or those with open balances for purchasing the products, were then told that they would be referred to an attorney or collection agency, according to the government. The complaint alleges the defendants continued to call consumers despite the consumers having told the defendants to stop calling and to place the consumer's telephone number on the defendant's internal do not call list. As part of a settlement with the FTC, the brothers also agreed to a permanent ban on telemarketing and will hand over a residential property. We want to stop robocalls and make it easier for consumers to safely answer the phone, acting FCC Chairwoman Jessica Rosenwood concluded. So, holy Christmas. 45 million robocalls.
Man.
Yeah.
I know at one time, I think I was getting 3 a day about the extended warranty. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Bonkers, huh?
Yep.
Well, Tim, I don't know that I want to live in a world where Florida man can't walk on a beach while playing a tuba.
I don't want to. Yeah.
Yeah. Florida man says he's no longer allowed to play his tuba on the beach. Derek Nangle said Beach Patrol stopped him while he was cranking on tunes at Fort Myers Beach on Friday, according to WBBH, the Bubba. Nangle, a music therapy major at Florida Gulf Coast University, said he loves to play and called the music absence of stress. Roger Hernstedt, a town manager, told Nagel that playing his tuba violated the entertainment ordinance. Nangle wrote to the town council to ask the rules be changed, but Hernstadt said unless that happens, officials can fine him for disobeying, according to WBBH, the Bubba, Tim.
The Bubba.
Yeah. So you're just, you know, you're just a guy out enjoying. Boy, can you imagine the weird sunburn he's got to have with that tuba shadow on him?
I can imagine it's very Two-Face like. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can you tell me how to get? How to get to Criminal Street. A group of thieves stole a $160,000 costume of Sesame Street's Big Bird, but they returned it, leaving a note with an apology for being such a big burden.
Aww.
B-I-R-D-E-N.
No.
Wah, wah. A group of thieves who stole a $160,000 costume of Sesame Street's Big Bird returned it a few days later with a note in his beak apologizing for being such a big burden. This is a story that just came out 18 hours ago. I could have sworn we had a story like this a few years back.
We did. Somebody stole a Big Bird costume and returned it. I would call it a repeat offender, Dave.
Is this a copycat Big Bird offender?
It is, yeah, yeah.
Dubbing themselves the Big Bird Bandits, the thieves stole the giant yellow avian costume in mid-April from the Sesame Street Circus Spectacular in Adelaide, Australia. We had no idea what we were doing or what our actions would cause, the note said. We were just having a rough time and we were trying to cheer ourselves up. We had a great time with Mr. Bird. He's a great guy and no harm came to our friend. Sorry to be such a big bird. And I know this is the same story. This is the exact same story. Are these guys just repeatedly hitting the same Sesame Street live events? What kind of weird ass world do you live in where you're like, dudes, Sesame Street's coming back to town. We need to go liberate the bird.
How do you say in the same sentence, we had a great time with Mr. Bird, but no harm was done?
All right. They went to like a furry convention. Was he treated like a celebrity for furry sex?
I think so. Yeah.
For listeners, go treat yourself. Look up furries. Furries are people that like to wear like mascot and animal costumes and copulate in those costumes. Not physically. I don't believe they're legitimately having
Dave.
Sex. They just like to.
Oh, no, Dave, look further in.
Oh, some of them do. See, I was at Dragon Con the first time I saw this unfurl. It was late at night and I was on like the second or third floor of one of the hotels and I looked down and there were all these mascots screwing in the lobby. Just banging away, you know, it was the weirdest thing. And I just stopped and I looked and I go, what's going on? They go, those are furries. And I go, what the hell is a furry? Well, it's this group that they get off on. I go, well, how do you know who's inside? You don't. You could be making love to a male furry if you're a male furry, or a female furry. And sometimes the more feminine looking creatures are males inside, and sometimes the more masculine looking creatures are females inside. So you just can't tell. It's about getting your inner freak on. And I stood there amazed. Amazed watching this unfurl, but they were, you know, it was dry humping, truthfully, from what I was seeing. But what a strange group.
There's another level.
There's another level. There's, you have to buy into level. That. Is it like Fight Club?
Yeah, I think it takes place in some of the more private rooms after hours. But let's just say if you were on a Big Bird costume, it would probably be King Bird. You'd be wearing a crown and you'd probably be officiating over the whole deal.
Wow. The King Bird. I like that.
Yeah.
All right. Here we go. A Nevada woman broke into a dentist office to steal thousands of dollars and also extracted 13 teeth from a victim, according to police. Laurel Ike, 42, was arrested earlier this week and charged with multiple felony counts, including burglary, grand larceny, and performing surgery without a license. In May, police responded to an after-hours break-in at a dental office in Sun Valley. They found an open door, broken window, $22,861 in cash and checks had been stolen. Washoe County Sheriff's Office identified Ike as a person of interest who was an employee at the dental office, but not a dentist. During the investigation, Ike confessed to detectives she had earlier performed 13 tooth extractions on one person despite not having a license. She admitted that she unlawfully performed the procedure and used anesthetic that had been disposed of by the dental office.
Well, now we know what happened to Hermie on the Rudolph cartoon.
That's right. I want to be a dentist, even if it's illegal and I have to break in to do it. According to the Daily Mail, the sheriff's office said she did the teeth extractions on her own time, but did not elaborate on the incident. Good God. What a crazy, crazy world. Our final story, a screwdriver-wielding man robs a Family Dollar store. Police are investigating an armed robbery that took place at a Family Dollar store in Newport on Sunday. The incident took place around 9 p.m. on the Main Street store location. A man armed simply with a screwdriver approached two cashiers demanding money. The suspect fled with an undisclosed amount of cash. The suspect is described as a white male, approximately 5 feet 8 inches tall with a thin build. At the time of the robbery, he was wearing an Under Armour ball cap, a gray Carhartt zip-up sweatshirt, shorts, black shoes, and a medical-style face mask. The man is also described as having a tattoo on his neck. Anyone with information regarding this incident is asked to contact Newport Police at 802-334-6733. So he was willing to unscrew all of the racks, Tim, if he didn't get what he was there for.
Jeez.
A screwdriver. That's the weirdest. Probably not the weirdest. We've listened to people being stabbed with swordfishes off of walls, right?
Yeah.
But it is definitely amongst the strangest. You know what? I'm going to do one more story, Tim, because okay. I feel like that one kind of let me down.
Well, yeah, that was it. Remember the New York subway killer who would use the screwdriver?
No.
Yeah. Don't you remember that? Bernie, what was his name?
Bernie Goetz is the one that shot him, wasn't it?
Well, was Bernie Goetz the guy who shot him, or was he the guy who used the screwdriver? Wait a minute. I got to look this up now.
Yeah, I can't recall. I thought Bernie Goetz was the guy who shot him. Shot somebody, but I didn't know it was that. While you're looking that up, I'm going to send you the mugshot for this next delightful felon. Are you ready, Tim?
I'm ready.
Our final story is truly here now, folks. So if you already signed out, you missed out on the what I think might be the best of all the stories. A Florida man was arrested, Tim.
Arrested.
After deputies found him using a pickle outside a private residence while wearing nothing below the waist. According to investigators, deputies were dispatched on a suspicious person call when the responding deputy spotted 47-year-old Eric, I'm not even going to try his last name, Detige, laying flat on his back with no pants or undies and on a private property in Oldsmar. In the affidavit, the deputy said that Detige had his penis in one hand and a large uneaten pickle in the other. Elaborating a bit further, the deputy reported that Detige was penetrating his rectum with the pickle whilst relieving himself, if you will.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. The incident was reported to happen at 4:40 p.m. 4:40 p.m. when the sun's still out, Tim. On March 14th, 2021, Dettige pleaded no contest to the exposed charge and was sentenced to the time served in Pinellas County Jail, which was 92 days, in order to pay fines, fees, and court costs, $550. Dettige, who has a lengthy criminal history of trespassing, littering, and battery, to just name a few, was arrested again in Hillsborough County on June 28th, 2021 for trespassing and released 2 days later on his own recognizance. According to arrest reports, Dettige has been arrested in Hillsborough County 58 times, dating back to 1995. His Pinellas arrest record rings in 6 arrests dating back to 2018 to include theft, resisting arrest, and pickling his own hole. Yeah, there you go.
Pickling his own.
Did you get the image?
Well, in 91, there was a subway stabber who used a screwdriver to assault 3 women in the Greenwich Soho area. That was one of them. There's been multiple subways. Wow. Yeah, but you were right about the shooter being Bernard Goetz in the subway. That was, yeah. I misquoted that one. But yeah, there's been multiple stabbers in subways with screwdrivers. I'm going through a bunch of them. In fact, there was one in May of 2021. A man was slashed, a tourist stabbed with a screwdriver in the New York City subway. That just happened in May.
People are weird.
Yeah, so screwdrivers are, I guess, good for stabbing.
I guess. I wouldn't do it, though, folks. No. You know, stick to playing tubas on the beach.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, that's it for this week, kids. I hope you enjoyed True Crime Tuesday. We'll be back with more of the best in paranormal podcasting, Darkness Radio, tomorrow, Thursday, and a special edition on Friday. Make sure you tune in Thursday night to our live video stream on our Darkness Radio YouTube page and social media pages. Check it out. Be a part of the program. Interact with us. Have some fun. That's it for this week. We'll be back again next week, and we've got a couple of doozies lined up for the next few weeks for True Crime Tuesday. I hope you'll check them out. I'm Dave. That's Tim. And this is True Crime Tuesday.